Yesterday, I talked about Dickensian feasts as symbols of human recreation. And we talked about the physical aspects of that and the way that the feast is kind of a renewal of the senses and something that is linked with the experience of your own individuality and life and freedom. And we also talked about the feast as a vision of affirmation in the world, or it can be quite the opposite too. We discussed the feast in terms of a gathering together of selves, of a community of delighters who gratify themselves but do it in company, and that was compared with Dickens' own art. And then finally, I mentioned that the feasts are rituals, and they involve other rituals like toasts and speeches and stories, and then afterwards some dancing and whatnot. And as rituals, the feasts are important for their continuity that they establish with your own past and your present and your future, and a feeling of regeneration. And today, what I'd like to do is put that in a biographical context. Talk about Dickens, the hungry boy, because Dickens was poor at one time, and out of his great hunger seems to have arose these feasts in his own imagination. In 1845, Dickens wrote an autobiographical fragment. Does anybody know about this? This retold an experience that he had when he was about 12 years old in London. He never told this to anybody for years and years. He didn't tell his wife or anyone, his best friends. He kept it secret. And the fact that he kept it secret is part of its power, I think, over him and then over his novels. When Charles was 12 and the family lived in London, he was sent out to work because the family had fallen on hard times. He worked by pasting labels on bottles of Warren's shoe blacking. A pretty demoralizing kind of occupation. And shortly thereafter, to make matters worse, his father was thrown into debtor's prison, to the Marshalsea debtor's prison. And that didn't last horribly long, but you know, to a child, time means nothing, and it seemed to him that it was all going to go on forever. And so, the child Dickens entered into a period of bleak despair, which was made worse by physical privations of different sorts. And I'd like to read to you some parts of this autobiographical fragment. I think you might be able to see in it certain themes and happenings that happened again in his novels. Maybe it will ring some bells for you if you've ever read any Dickens. He writes, "It is wonderful to me how I could have been so easily cast away at such an age. No one made any sign to help him or to send him to school like he wanted to do. The blacking warehouse was a crazy, tumble-down old house, abutting, of course, on the river, and literally overrun with rats. Its wainscoted rooms and its rotten floors and staircase, and the old gray rats swarming down in the cellars, and the sound of their squeaking and scruffling coming up the stairs at all times, and the dirt and decay of the place all rise up visibly before me as if I were there again." Dickens' fellow workers were some very common boys who didn't at all have the gifts of imagination and spirit that Dickens had. And he was very depressed by this companionship, although he was touched by it sometimes too. He goes on, "No words can express the secret agony of my soul as I sunk into this companionship and felt my early hopes of growing up to be a learned and distinguished man crushed in my breast. The deep remembrance of the sense I had of being utterly neglected and hopeless, the shame I felt in my position, the misery it was to my young heart to believe that day by day what I had learned and thought and delighted in and raised my fancy and my emulation up by was never to be brought back any more. My whole nature was so penetrated with grief and humiliation that even now, famous and caressed and happy, I often forget in my dreams that I have a dear wife and children, even that I am a man, and wander desolately back to that time of my life. And he did wander back to it many times in his novels, recreating the place and other places that stood in for that warehouse and that prison, and recreating the feelings that he had then. The young Dickens was kind of on his own. He didn't live with his parents, who were in the debtor's prison. He lived outside because he worked outside. So he was very lonesome. And he was on his own at dinner time, very young child, rather inexperienced, and had been sheltered and didn't quite know how to spend his money. But he would often buy some sausage or some cheese or a big chunk of bread from some miserable old public house nearby. He recalls vividly one incident, and this picture is from David Copperfield, a very autobiographical novel, something of this in that novel. Once I remember tucking up my own bread, which I had bought from home in the morning, under my arm, wrapped in a piece of paper like a book, and going into the best dining room in Johnson's a la mode beef house in Clare Court, Drury Lane, magnificently ordering a small plate of a la mode beef to eat with it. What the waiter thought of such a strange little apparition, coming in all alone, I don't know. But I can see him now staring at me as I ate my dinner and bringing up the other waiter to look. I gave him a halfpenny, and I wish now that he hadn't taken it. The idea of someone staring at you as you eat your dinner is common in Dickens, and it will turn up in Great Expectations later today. Saturday night, he goes on to tell, was a special treat. And his biographer, John Forster, who printed this autobiographical fragment, Forster was a good friend of Dickens, to whom Dickens showed this piece of writing. Forster records that Dickens found it a grand thing to walk home with 6 shillings in his pocket and to look in at the shop windows and wonder what it would buy. And sometimes, when he had no money at all, he would walk in Covent Garden, which is apparently a part of it is a great market. I've never been there. Has anyone been to Covent Garden? He would stare at the pineapples and all the exotic things there that he could never buy. He records memories of food in this fragment, and I think that's kind of interesting. There were, for instance, 2 particular puddings that he remembered. One was made with currants and was a rather special pudding, but was dear, 2 pennyworth not being larger than a pennyworth of more ordinary pudding. A good shop for more ordinary kind was in the Strand. It was a stout, hale pudding, heavy and flabby, with great raisins in it, stuck in whole at great distances apart. It came up hot at about noon every day, and many a day did I dine upon it. Another picture from David Copperfield of the little Dickens, or the little Dickens David, or the little Copperfield Charles, however you want to jumble those initials around, ordering something at a public house. And this really happened. One evening he went into a public house and said to the landlord behind the bar, "What is your very best, the very best ale, a glass?" For the occasion was a festive one for some reason, I forget why. It may have been my birthday or someone else's. "Tuppence," says he. "Then," says I, "just draw me a glass of that, if you please, with a good head to it." The landlord looked at me over the bar from head to foot with a strange smile upon his face, and instead of drawing the beer, looked round the screen and said something to his wife, who came out from behind it and joined him in surveying me. And they asked me a good many questions as to what my name was, how old I was, where I lived, how I was employed. To all of which, that I might commit nobody, I invented appropriate answers. The fragment is really not that awfully long, and I think it's interesting that Dickens should record these memories of food. Perhaps if you've ever been very hungry or alone, food becomes extra important to you, or maybe if you can't afford it, it seems all the more wonderful. And if you're lonely, especially as he was. So it seems that when you read the whole fragment, as though Dickens had two kinds of riches. One were these imaginations of food and the kind of expectation and excitement that generated. And the other was stories. He had read many of the good old 18th century novels and other kinds of fairy tales and things like Ali Baba and Robinson Crusoe was another favorite of his. And he remembered these stories and he would tell them to his companions, trying to keep the plots in mind and the characters, because his parents had to sell his books. It was the first thing they sold for money, and they didn't get very much for it either. But both food and these stories engaged his imagination. And at this time, remember my saying that he feared that his hopes of growing up to be a distinguished and learned man were crushed in his breast? Well, that was associated with his imagination, as though that were the source of his hopes, his imagination. A lot of us today, I think, when we think about getting ahead in society, we don't connect imagination with that. Imagination is something extra you do on the side in your leisure time. But for Dickens, somehow his imagination and his hopes and his social yearnings, all of it was jumbled up together. And even in later life, Dickens feared that his imagination would be taken away. Even though when he was tremendously successful, more than we can even imagine today, he feared that his imagination would fail him. And I think that it was terribly important to him. It was a kind of recompense for all of life's disappointments, and he had many of them. He was a very sensitive person. He had disappointments with his family, his primary family, and then his wife and other relatives. He had disappointments in his career and life generally. There are several things that keep turning up in the novels. One is the debtor's prison. The Marshalsea is a central image in this novel that I read to you from yesterday that not too many people have heard of, Little Dorrit. The family, the Dorrits, are in the prison. And that's the most direct Dickens gets. In some ways, all of his novels are autobiographical in different ways. But there's the Marshalsea prison, and there are workhouses like in Oliver Twist, and orphanages, and various kinds of institutions like that kind of stand in for the prison. And sometimes he seems to see all of England as a prison. It's a prison that does not appreciate artists, that is crushing the poor, that is strangled by bureaucratic red tape, and so on. The idea of confinement is very strong in Dickens novels. Besides the image of the prison, the idea of sustainment is also important. And that word turns up in a couple of the novels. It's just a word, and its synonyms keep turning up. It's a key word in that way. And Dickens is very concerned with what can sustain us in this prison of our lives. What is sustaining? And so in a way, the feasts are an important image of that, because they're an ordinary occasion for sustenance to be gathered into yourself. And they very often will focus different values of what he did think was sustaining. So perhaps for Dickens, it seems that the prison on the one hand and his art on the other, as though they were opposites, as though his art made up for the debts of life that can never really be paid back, the debts of suffering and of disappointment. And so the art is kind of the opposite of the prison. With the picture of the hungry boy in mind, let's leap ahead to the phenomenally successful novelist, the caricature of him made by one of his contemporaries, I believe. 15 years after this autobiographical fragment was written, and 5 years, or excuse me, 10 years after David Copperfield was written, and you know that's a very autobiographical novel, Great Expectations was written. And in many ways, this too is quite autobiographical. Although it's a lot darker than the earlier novel, and I'm hoping that we can really get into it this afternoon. What I'm going to suggest are just some general things this morning. Great Expectations is a novel about growth and fulfillment, survival, hunger and frustration. And the feast and the meals in the novel and different kinds of eating and figurative references to eating are all ways that Dickens expresses different values, different things in this novel. And one of the things that the feasts and meals do is to give the characters who are sitting there eating together moral and social definition. Now this is very important, and I'll give you an example from another novel of how moral and social definition can come through a meal. This is from Little Dorrit. These people are taking their tea in the prison, in the Marshalsea prison. And of course people can come in and out of the prison, but the prisoners themselves can't get out, but other friends can come in, and so there are a few extra people here. And the man here on the end, I can use this right here, is the host. And he looks a little bit jolly and he looks a little bit fat, his chest is swelled out. And he is making this into a genteel occasion, even though he's a jailbird in disgrace. And this is his daughter with genteel leanings over here. Notice her posture. She is trying very hard, too, to make it a genteel occasion. And you can tell she's going to succeed a little better than he is. You know, she's younger, she's pretty, but she's also very false and is choosing a false posture for her life. And this woman standing up here with the toasting fork in her hand and the toast steaming off of it is a retarded child who kind of waits on them. She's the servant. And if you're genteel, you have to have a servant, right? And then this man in front, well, he's just an extra guest. He doesn't really figure in this very much. And the other woman standing next to the man here is his daughter, and she's the good daughter. She's really serving him. She's bending over him. Well, the guest at this feast is Nandy, who has a birthday. He has been let out of the workhouse today in order that he can go over to the debtor's prison with his friends and have a birthday party. That's what life is, one prison after the other. Here he is. He's as far away as he can get without falling out the window. They don't want him sitting at the table. And he is a pretty miserable old character, that's true. But the host is sitting there making comparisons, saying, "Old Nandy's, his voice is really going, his legs are really getting weak, you know." And Nandy is sitting there taking this all very politely and really being a lot more genteel and gentle than the host is. The host uses his guest in order to make himself look better. I don't know if you've ever encountered that in your own social lives, but maybe it will ring a bell. Well, you can see by the placement of the people even that Dickens often will use the meal as an occasion on which to show where people stand or sit morally and socially. In Great Expectations, I wish I had more pictures from that novel, but there weren't very many, and there are a lot of feasts and meals in it, but not very many pictures of them. I don't know why. But in Great Expectations, you can tell a Pip's own development. Now Pip is the hero, sort of, a boy who grows up, and you can watch his development through the novel by his behavior at different meals, and how people treat him, and how he acts, and what kind of manners he has, and how he eats, and so on. And I can give you an example of three stages in his life. These are meals at Pumblechook's. Now Pumblechook is his so-called uncle, not really his blood uncle, but pretends like he's his rich uncle, and he really isn't rich at all. And Pumblechook pretends that he is Pip's benefactor, when in fact the benefactor is someone else. None of them even know who it is. But he acts as though he's helped him on in life. Well, why does someone do that? So that you'll help him in return when you get rich. You know? And so when Pip's expectations of money and great fortune are announced to him, and this is a little before that, actually. This is when he is going to Miss Havisham's house, and she represents something of his expectations. It's very vague. They don't know exactly what she's going to give him, but it looks like he's going to move up in society and move away from this carpenter's this blacksmith's life that he's been leading in the country. So he's going to the town, and he's going to go to this woman's house. She wants him there. She's really eccentric. They don't know why she wants him there, but he's going. And they wash him, you know, and get him all dressed up and stuff him into a penitential suit, as many little boys probably think of their suits. And then he goes to Pumblechook's before he goes over to her house. If you've read the plot summary, it would help. But anyway, he's eating breakfast with this man who thinks he's his benefactor. Said, I considered Mr. Pumblechook wretched company. Besides being possessed by the idea that a mortifying and penitential character ought to be imparted to my diet, besides giving me as much crumb as possible in combination with as little butter, and putting such a quantity of warm water into my milk that it would have been more candid to have left the milk out altogether. His conversation consisted of nothing but arithmetic. On my politely bidding him good morning, he said pompously, 7 times 9, boy. And how should I be able to answer, lodged in that way in a strange place on an empty stomach? I was hungry, but before I had swallowed a morsel, he began a running sum that lasted all through breakfast. 7 and 4 and 8 and 6 and 2, and so on. And after each figure was disposed of, it was as much as I could do to get a bite or a sup before the next came, while he sat at his ease guessing nothing and eating bacon in a hot roll in a gorging and gormandizing manner. And he's persecuting this young boy. But when he finds out that the boy really is rich, or going to be rich, then he treats him a little bit differently. And this is when Pip comes back to the town and has, I guess it's a breakfast or a lunch with Pumblechook. He acts a little bit differently. My dear friend, says Mr. Pumblechook, taking me by both hands, I give you joy of your good fortune. Well deserved, well deserved. This was coming to the point, and I thought it a sensible way of expressing himself. To think, said Mr. Pumblechook, snorting admiration at me, that I should have been the humble instrument of leading up to this is a proud reward. He did have a little bit of a role in Pip's becoming rich, but not really very much at all, just a tiny little thing or two that he did. But he acts as though he did it all. My dear young friend, said Mr. Pumblechook, you must be hungry, you must be exhausted. Be seated. Here's a chicken had round from the boar, public house. Here's a tongue had round from the boar. Here's one or two little things had round from the boar that I hope you may not despise. And then he commences, instead of doing the mathematics kind of mechanical routine as he did, you know, when Pip was a little boy, He does another kind of mechanical thing, and that is he keeps wanting to shake hands with Pip and congratulate him. And so he keeps saying, may I, and shakes his hand. And Pip really can't eat at this occasion either. He starts to lift up his teacup and says, may I, and he shakes hands. And they shake hands hundreds of times during the meal. And then Mr. Pumblechook addresses an allegory to the fowl that's on the table. Says, you little soft poultry, ah, poultry, when you was a young fledgling, what was in store for you? You little thought you was to be refreshment beneath this humble roof for such a one as, he means Pip, who is now rich, and he says, may I. And in a way, you know, he's apostrophizing the fowl, but in a way he's talking to Pip, saying, you little knew what was in store for you, didn't you? And this identification of Pip with food is interesting when we get to the cannibalism motif in this novel. Well, anyway, this is the way they go at it, and they get very drunk together, and Pip, who is becoming a very snobbish person by now, thinks that Pumblechook is really a great guy. And then at the end of the novel, when Pip loses his money, Pumblechook acts very differently towards him because of the difference in social station. He greets him and he says, I'm sorry to see you brought so low. But what else could be expected? What else could be expected? And instead of shaking hands in that former way, he extends his hands with a magnificently forgiving air as if I was broken by illness. And though I, because I was unbroken by illness and unfit to quarrel, I took his hand. But the hand is not extended, honestly. And he has, Pumblechook has the air of a benefactor who was resolved to be true to the last. And he orders a muffin, that's all, for Pip. And he offers to pour his tea, and he breathes down Pip's neck, pouring this tea and acting very injured but very forgiving, as though he had to forgive Pip for Pip losing his own money. And then he's breathing down Pip's back, and finally Pip says, "In heaven's name, leave that teapot alone." And then Pumblechook gets his moment of revenge, and he says, "You are right to tell me to leave that pot alone." And then he goes into his hurt dignity routine and says that he always saw the handwriting on the wall with Pip's expectations, and that the handwriting read, "Reward of ingratitude to your earliest benefactor and founder of your fortunes," as though Pip was not grateful enough to the man who didn't help him anyway. And so they go from the mathematical sums through the wonderful feast offered dishonestly to the single muffin on the plate that doesn't seem to taste very good anymore. So there are different ways too, and this is more of a minor strand in the novel than some of the others, which you can see how Pip develops according to how he's treated at meals and how he treats others. This is a picture from the novel. This is, I think at the end of the novel there's another Pip that's born, but anyway, this symbolizes Pip's childhood sitting by the fire, some moments of domestic tranquility that he had. I don't know who that is peeping in the door. I think that's the grown-up Pip. Yeah. And this is his godson named after him. But that's the feeling of warmth that is possible even in this novel now and then. Because for Dickens, the individual person is nourished in community. So community is itself a sustaining thing. And many of the meals in the novels are not sustaining, or there's no communion at them, or they're mere shows of fellow feeling. They're not really nourishing. And very often the hosts, like Pumblechook in this example I read, are hypocrites, and if they're generous, they want you to be grateful, and there's always a catch. A lot of parents, I think even today, are like that sometimes. You've got to be grateful, you know. Well, as social occasions, meals also show off people's manners. And so from their manners, you can tell what kind of a person they are, whether they're a crude country bumpkin or some kind of city slicker or whatever. And the meals will show people's discomfort, too, in the company of the other people. This is a picture from Old Curiosity Shop. Can you see it? This is not at all a nourishing meal. This guy Quilp, who is a money lender, and he has invited two of his other cronies in economic crimes, financial dealings, to tea in the summer house, as he calls it. And he is a real sadistic character. You can see him sitting up there on the right, sitting on top of the table. He's very crude and everything. Those are his guests on the left. And his man in waiting, sitting down there under the umbrella, laughing fit to burst his sides. And he calls this tea in the summer house. And this was summer house was in an advanced state of decay overlooking the slimy banks of a great river at low water. Nevertheless, it was in this choice retreat that Mr. Quilp ordered tea to be prepared. And he says to his guest, "You are fond of the beauties of nature. Isn't it charming? Isn't it unusual, unsophisticated, and primitive?" "It's delightful indeed, sir," replied his guest. "And cool," said Pip. No, not particularly so, sir," said Brass, with his teeth chattering in his head. "Perhaps a little damp and eggish," said Quilp. "Just damp enough to be cheerful at," rejoined Brass. "Nothing more, sir, nothing more." But trying not to be rude to their host when it's so obviously miserable. Kind of a caricature of the feast that can be a punishment and a sadistic thing. Great expectations is also about consumption and self-gratification. There are metaphors of food and hunger throughout the novel that give an idea of what appetite is all about. Great expectations, in a way, means one of its meanings is great appetite. Not great fulfillment, just big appetite, that's all. And the different kinds of food in the novel suggest what he is hankering after. And he's hankering after not only some kind of community, but also some things that, for him at least, are not quite so good: money, position, even sex. And the urge to consume backfires. Pip lusts after certain things, and he is nearly consumed by them. And that's true of other characters, too. And the novel is built out of poetic justices, reversals, ironic reversals. And the idea of the reversal is a common plot device, but in Dickens it takes on a special kind of moral meaning for his characters. In this novel, Miss Havisham, and here's where I really wish I had a picture, but I have one in this book, if you want to look at it later. Miss Havisham is a strange, eccentric woman who takes Pip in and kind of uses him for her own very strange purposes. She's an eccentric woman who is been sitting in her house with the clock stopped at 9:15 ever since she was left at the altar by a man in her youth who took her for all he could get and left. And she's kept her house the same all these years. And Pip comes to her house expecting some, because she's very rich too, expecting some kind of wonderful vision. And here's what he sees. She was dressed in rich materials, satin and lace and silk, all of white. Her shoes were white. And she had a long white veil dependent from her hair, and she had bridal flowers in her hair, but her hair was white. Some bright jewels sparkled on her neck and on the table. Dresses were half-packed in trunks and scattered about. She had not quite finished dressing, for she had but one shoe on, and the other was on the table, and her veil was but half arranged. But Pip notices that everything which ought to be white had been white long ago, but now was faded and yellow. And the bride within the bridal dress had withered like the dress and like the flowers, and had no brightness left but the brightness of her sunken eyes. I saw the dress had been put upon the rounded figure of a young woman, and that the figure upon which it hung was now loose, had shrunken to skin and bone. And Pip compares her to waxworks he's seen at the fair and to skeletons. He calls her waxwork and skeleton, his dark eyes that look at him. So Miss Havisham is involved in a number of reversals, and if you've taken a look at the plot summary, you can guess what they are. She has been trying to make some kind of revenge for the act of this young man upon her life and her great disappointment. And her act of revenge is to raise up an orphan to be a beautiful man killer, a gorgeous young woman with a heart, you know, of just ice, icy eyes, so on. And one of the reversals is that this one person she's close to doesn't love her. Of course not. She didn't teach this young woman, Estella, to love. But there are other kinds of reversals too. For instance, in this old dress, she becomes tender. The dress becomes brittle and dry. And she's standing by the fire one night, and the fire catches her dress. She goes immediately up into flames. And Pip is standing there, and he rescues her. And she struggles against him. She wants to be consumed. And she is consuming herself. So a lot of the imagery of the feast and consumption, you have the fire consuming. There are other kinds of reversals she's involved in, too. Maybe I should save those for later. But she is punishing herself. You know, in trying to punish someone else, she's really punishing herself for her sins and for things done to her. But there are other kinds of reversals, too, and those are reconciliatory. I jotted down what a couple of those are. She uses Pip. She plays with him. She dangles Estella, this beautiful woman, before his eyes and tries to get him to fall in love with Estella. And Pip eventually, at the very end of the novel, forgives her for doing this to him. Because, of course, she had raised up great expectations that were not satisfied. And he forgives her, and this is how he does it. He says, in enduring her trial, her trials in life, she really didn't realize mine. She didn't understand. She didn't know what she was doing. And he reverses that, too, and he says, and in enduring my trial in life, I really can't be bitter with her. And I can see her need for forgiveness, and so I forgive her. And she, in watching him fall in love with Estella, all of a sudden realizes that he feels toward Estella as she had felt towards the young man many years ago. And as soon as she can identify with her victim, with Pip, then all of a sudden she feels sympathy with him. And then forgiveness and some kind of reconciliation is possible. But before that, she can't see her own guilt. So there are reversals that can be healing as well as reversals that can be punishing. Well, the darker side of the hunger and consumption motif is a motif of cannibalism. Now, this is a picture from another novel that I won't go into a lot of explanation about. But can you see this sharp-looking woman in the middle with the knife, the butter knife or the bread knife or whatever it is, pointed toward their servant? Now, they're really not going to eat her, but they do exploit her an awfully lot. And this is a very crude family. It's called the Small Weed family. And this sense of people being threatened by other people and the idea of weapons and cannibalism is very strong in Great Expectations. Nobody actually bites into a succulent other person, but people exploit each other economically and emotionally, as Miss Havisham exploits this orphan, Estella, using her for her own purposes, and as she exploits Pip. The exploitation of people by other people is accompanied by guilt, which sometimes takes the form of indigestion, a kind of spiritual indigestion, I guess. You may not remember this, but in Christmas Carol, which I was reading on the way out here in the car, I rediscovered that when Marley's ghost comes to Scrooge in his room to announce that the other ghosts are coming, Scrooge doesn't believe in it. You know, Scrooge doesn't have a whole lot of imagination, right? He's a crabbed old person. And he says, I don't believe in you. You're just an undigested bit of potato. And, you know, that idea of hallucinations coming from his own indigestion. But the interesting thing is that Marley is, in a way, a sign of Scrooge's spiritual indigestion, because Marley represents Scrooge's guilt. He has a long chain on that he carries around, and it's cash boxes and other things like that, you know, that had to do with the money trade. But anyway, there's that form of spiritual indigestion, because people are not meant for human consumption. And the body and the life rebels, and there is always some kind of punishment in store for the cannibal in Dickens' novel. The cannibal, and this is true in Africa, I suppose, too, but a cannibal is someone who eats another person in order to get their own spirit, to take upon them their life. And the urge to possess and to get power over other people is very strong throughout Great Expectations. Here's another illustration from the novel. This is Pip here on this ladder, lashed to the ladder. They're out in a secluded spot, and this is an enemy who has social and psychological reasons for hating Pip. And this man is sitting there with a looks like a gun on his lap, but it's really a stone hammer. And he has just quaffed a great big mug of drink of some kind or another. So in a way, he's sitting by a table. And he says, among other things in this scene, he says, now I've got you. There's that feeling about Great Expectations. And this is the most terrifying moment when he lifts this stone hammer to smash Pip. and you can get the few ones to eat him. He's going to throw him into the lime kiln, which will eat up Pip's body, and they will never see him again. But someone comes in and rescues him. Pip, in the main plot, and this is just a kind of a subplot, Pip is a bought-up gentleman. And he is bought up by a guy named Magwitch, who is a rich stranger, once was a convict, whom Pip had befriended as a little boy. We'll talk about that later today. And Magwitch has been very misused by a lot of high society people and government people and law enforcement people. And he wants to get back at them. He wants to take his revenge. They treat him as though he's a complete animal, and he does become partly an animal. And so he decides that he is going to make a gentleman. He wants to own a gentleman. And so he manages to get this money to Pip. He finds out where Pip lives and who he is, and gets the money to him in a secret way, and then later on he appears. And then finally, when he does come into Pip's life and says, "Here I am, I'm the source of your great expectations and all your fortune and the money you've been spending and the debts you've been running up, I'll pay him off because I want to own a gentleman." Pip is rather offended by this. He feels, you know, the threat to his own life. But there is also something kind in the man's remembrance of how Pip befriended him. It's a strange mixture of a cannibalistic kind of thing and also a human community kind of thing. The old prisoner who returns really needs someone to live with and to be with. But in general, the cannibalism imagery in this novel and in other novels kind of stands for the savagery of Dickens' own very, very civilized British society. It's really a very savage place. And very often in his novels, somebody has to exploit other people and condescend to them in order to be considered a gentleman, in order to live by the rules. I'd like to give you a few examples of some of the cannibalism in the novel, of how it comes about. There's Miss Havisham's cannibalistic sort of theory or philosophy of love that she tells to Pip. She wants Pip to fall in love with Estella so that Estella will break his heart. That's what she wants. That will make her happy, she thinks. And so she tells him, "If she tears your heart to pieces, love her, love her, love her." It's not only kind of a cannibalism, it's submitting to be cannibalized, because she herself had had her heart torn to pieces by this man that she had loved. And then she says again, "Real love is blind devotion, unquestioning self-humiliation, utter submission, giving up your whole heart and soul to the smiter, as I did." And when Pip talks about Estella, there's a little bit of Lord's Supper in here, I think. He talks about her in the same kind of way. He says, "You are part of my existence, part of myself, the embodiment of every graceful fancy, part of my character, part of the little good in me, part of the evil." And when he makes this great disclosure to the cold Estella, the words gushed out like blood from an inward wound. He talked as though he had eaten her, as though they had become one flesh. And when you think about what good nourishment is, it's not aspiration in itself or this passion to possess someone if he wanted to possess her, and she is a very sexual being too. But nourishment is something rather different from that. The mutuality, and in cannibalism there is no mutuality of sharing. There is simply a powerful person and a powerless person, one who is eaten and the eater. Havisham is also cannibalistic towards Estella, towards this woman that she has brought up. So it's said that she looks at Estella greedily, devouring the beautiful creature she had reared, and she has a miserly relish of Estella's capricious moods with which she tortures men. And constantly in their conversation in Miss Havisham's house, the words have, take, give, phrases like "I took her," "I want her," "I have her," those kinds of words of possession are constantly turning up. And then Havisham is cannibalistic towards herself. And she's very eccentric, strange character, but she really is very much like the other characters who are very normal and ordinary for the rest of the society. So, although she has a strange dimension, it's a matter of degree. Is it different from others? She says of herself, sharper teeth than teeth of mice have gnawed at me. Let me read to you a description of her her bridal cake that was mentioned yesterday. She keeps this room, this feast, this decayed feast, her bridal feast, intact all these years. And little Pip is coming into this room, doesn't know what to think. But every discernible thing in the room was covered with dust and mold and dropping to pieces. The most prominent object was a long table with a tablecloth spread on it, as if the feast had been in preparation and the house and clocks all stopped together. A centerpiece of some kind was in the middle. It was so heavily overhung with cobwebs that its form was quite indistinguishable. And as I looked along the yellow expanse out of which I remembered its seeming to grow like a black fungus, I saw a speckle-legged spider, its blotchy body, running home to it and running out from it, as if some circumstance of the greatest public importance had just transpired in the spider community. I heard the mice rattling behind the panel, but the black beetles took no notice of the agitation and groped about the hearth in a ponderous, elderly way, as if they were short-sighted and hard of hearing and not on terms with one another. Anyway, she points to the cake with her long, skinny fingers, and she says, what do you think that is? That where those cobwebs are. I can't guess what it is, ma'am, she says. It's a great cake, a bride cake, mine. Great Expectations is a darker novel than many of the others in some ways, and its feastings are dissatisfying. They do not meet expectations. They do not fill the appetite. And in this novel, which is the story of a boy's growing up, basic needs are not met. There is a tea party with Estella that Pip has. He's lucky enough to have her company for a little while, and everything is brought into the tea party except the tea, you know? At all sorts of spoons and cups and saucers and cakes, but no tea. It's typical of the kind of thing that's happening here where his basic needs are not met. He has no parents, and he's advised by this eccentric old horrible woman. He has the basic needs for community that he has. He throws away the opportunities he has for that, or most of them. And finally, he loses his great expectations. It's interesting that at the first stage of Pip's adventure out into the world from this rural community where he's brought up, it says, and the last words are, and the world lay spread before him as though it were a feast for him to partake of, but it has nothing very nourishing in it. And in some ways, maybe Dickens felt like that too, even in his later life. Well, the novel opens with a scene that it takes place on a wasteland in a marsh. And there is, two chapters later, a meal on that wasteland. And it starts out with all sorts of images that have nothing to do or seemingly to be the opposite of all the values of the feast and the community that I talked about yesterday. And I thought I might read that, except that it's getting a little bit late. And we do need to go to lunch eventually and need to do some discussion. So maybe what we could do is meet again at 4 if you'd like to come. You don't have to read anything, but I have things you can read if you want. And we could talk about, we can read over and talk about this, just the first 4 chapters. They have 2 incredible meals in them and all kinds of interesting interactions among the characters that foreshadow things that are going to come later. And so we can dip right into the novel that way. If you'd like to do that. Do you have anything you'd like to respond to? I talked pretty long. Things that struck you about this, or perhaps you've read the novel recently and remember things, or other novels.